Good afternoon. My name is Paul Walters, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic. I'd like to dispel a rumor I heard earlier about me, that I heard that I was so old that when I started drinking, the Dead Sea wasn't even sick yet. That is not true. It had a bad cough at the time. My job to tell you what happened in my life and how Alcoholics Anonymous changed and how I live today. So we'll start off in the beginning, which is a good place. I was born in Great Memorial Hospital in Atlanta. It was September the 29th, 3 a.m., and my mom and dad told me it was sleet and rain at the time. I'm the sixth child of the family. I have three older sisters and two older brothers that are twins, and they let me know right often that they needed another little brother like a hole in the head. Dad was bad to drink, they used to call it back then, and if you look at my family lineage, we've been able to track them all the way back to England and when they came to Virginia and all down through the Carolinas and Kentucky and Georgia. They were moonshiners. So I grew up in third generation Georgia moonshining family, and you had a job that you worked on pretty much kind of, but the rest of it was everybody was loading up something, hauling it here and there. And I learned by the age of 15 how to haul shine. But I grew up in this alcoholic family. Dad drank really bad. Mom was real religious. She never drank a drop in her life, and she did the best she could with six kids. Dad and Mom never had much of an education. They were pretty well illiterate. They could read and write just enough to get by. And Dad drank a lot. So he drank up most of the money that was needed for everything. In my early childhood, I can remember associating that blood meant death. Because we'd ride down the road in a car going to the grocery store and here and there and out to Sunday dinner over grandma's or something, and I'd see a dog on the side of the road and a puddle of blood, and I knew that meant that that animal was dead. At the age of three, I knew that. And one day, Dad came in, and he was bad to come in home with a blackout, and I didn't know what it was at the time, but he'd come in screaming and yelling in a fit and just beating on everybody. He came in the house in that shape one day and started beating on Mom and us kids, and the blood spattered when he hit Mom in the face all over me and the refrigerator, and I knew at the age of three that meant dead. That scared me, and I didn't know what to do. And so that started this terror, this fear, this self-centered internal frustration that I did not know how to cope with. And I knew it had something to do with Dad going crazy. Blood meant death. And alcohol was mixed in there somewhere. By the time I was 4 years old, I'm watching my uncles and aunts fight each other at family reunions. And I remember them telling me over through the years that when I was 2 years old at family reunions, they go, "Watch out with that one over there. That's little Claude. He bites." And so I got swatted a lot as a young child because I don't know why I would walk up and bite you. I would just walk up and bite you. So there was something unmanageable about my thinking from the start, you see. I always felt out of place. I didn't feel like I fit in the family that I was in. Even at the age of 4 and 5 years old, there was something wrong with me, and I knew it. It didn't help any that my brothers and sisters would let me know that they didn't want me neither. Our family was not the hugging, kissing kind. Mom and Dad didn't hug and kiss us kids or each other. And so I did not know or learn how to show affection. I didn't learn that early on in life like a lot of people do. When I was 9 years old, see, we were living in this one place right over here in Fair Oaks, which is close by here. And every year at Easter, we would sell rabbits and chickens and doves and things to people. We'd have a sign out there for about a week before Easter Sunday. People would stop by the house and buy these animals from us. And I had this one rabbit that I had raised from the litter the year earlier because it was a runt. It was going to die, and I took care of it. And I raised that sucker, and he was a real big, pretty rabbit. And it was well kept in a nice pen down on the end of all the other pens with the other rabbits, and that was my pet. And Easter rolls around, Saturday before Easter Sunday, and people were coming in the yard buying chickens and rabbits and doves, and this one kid wanted to buy that rabbit on the end in the pen down there. That was mine. I kept telling him, that was not for sale. That's mine. That's my pet. And Dad heard me say that one time, because I convinced the kid to buy another one. So the next day, which is Easter Sunday, it's about 10:30 in the morning, Dad comes out of the house with a tall boy Schlitz in one hand and a claw-handled hammer in the other. And he walks over to the end of the pen where my rabbit's at, sets the bear on top, pulls the rabbit out by its back legs, hits it in the head with a hammer, and throws it on the chopping block, and says, "Now you clean and dress that rabbit, boy, because you're going to take it inside, your mama's going to cook it, and you're going to eat it. There ain't no damn pets around here." And I did. Mama cooked it, and Dad made me eat every bit of that. And that kicked off a resentment, a deep-seated anger toward my dad and any authority figure. So now I've already got something wrong with my thinking, because I like to walk up and bite you. Yeah. And people taking a swat at me all the time, and I'm building up this anger and rage from the age of 9. So I already had something wrong with me. I was born an alcoholic, because it's on both sides of the family. I'm Scottish, Irish, and Cherokee. It's like I had a chance. You know? They should check our family background. They're Cherokee or grandma's side of both mom's and dad's family. So I was born this way. It was just all the isms and everything were there from the get-go. Because when I was a kid in the 50s, the doctors would tell the moms, you know, well, if the child is not gaining weight, you just put a little beer in their bottle and let them drink some beer, and it'll help them with their appetite and they'll gain weight. And also, if the child is teething, well, you just take a white cotton cloth and you soak it in some hard liquor and you rub it on their gums, and that'll help them when they're teething. They won't cry so much. So, I had alcohol in my system from the get-go. I mean, from birth. When I came out, they put an alcohol in my bottle, rubbing it on my gums, and it was just everywhere all the time. Because I was a smart little kid. By the age of 9, I was watching where Dad was hiding his liquor. And I'm watching where my uncles and aunts, when we go over to their house, where they're hiding their liquor. You know, and I found out, you know, there's something to this liquor thing, but I wasn't quite sure what it was. And one day, I come down with pneumonia, and Dad didn't take you to the hospital for nothing unless you couldn't sew it back on or stop the bleeding, pretty much. And I'm laying there in bed, and I'm seriously dying. I hurt like I had never hurt before in my life. Physical pain, I couldn't breathe, I'm sweating, I'm just weak, I'm shaking. And he walks into the bedroom with a double shot of moonshine. And he's got a little piece of that soft Christmas candy in there, and he stirs it with his finger until it dissolves. He goes, "Now you drink this, boys." He said, "You toss it on back. You seen how this man do it?" I said, "Okay." And I tossed that stuff back. Now, if you've ever drank Georgia moonshine or any moonshine, you will notice right off the bat, it tastes like a possum been dead for 3 days. God-awful taste. Burns all the way down. But it hit bottom of my stomach and just exploded. And I got these warm fuzzies all over. At the age of 9, I went, "Oh." You know, I knew why they drank that stuff then. It stopped the pain immediately. I mean, I felt great. I immediately asked him, I said, "Can I have another one?" He goes, "Hell no, you can't have another one." He says, "Stay under them sheets and you sweat it out, boy, until you get better." So I started planning right then. You know, I went and picked up enough Coke bottles after I got over that and bought me a canteen that I could put on my side. And I bought two of them. One to carry water in while we were out playing army and everything, and the other one to go around to everybody's bottle and steal a little bit of their shine or their hard liquor and pour it in it. So I had my two-fisted drinker already at the age of 9, you know. I got one canteen of water in it to chase it with, because I found out right quick that stuff burns all the time, so you got to have something to chase it, because I watched the big guys take a shot of something and then chase it with a beer or something, because you had to chase it with something, because the look on their face would tell you, "God, that stuff must burn like hell." And it did. So at the age of 9, I'm already scheming, and I got access to liquor at any time now. And I did. I had my little stash where I could hide the stuff. My brothers were a bit cruel to me. They didn't want to watch out for me like most big brothers do. They had a bad habit of tying me up and throwing me under the house in a root cellar. And that was a bit difficult to get out of, so I was learning the Houdini technique early on in life. But the bad thing was there were so many spiders down there. The first time I got bit up so bad that by the time I kicked a concrete cinder block out of the foundation to get out, I was covered in spiders. I mean covered. And I ran in the house and I took a shower, peeled off all my clothes, and I had to scrape the spiders off of me, and I began to sting, burn, and hurt severely. So I went and found Dad's Sassy Shine and took me two big gulps off of that, and I found it kills that kind of pain too. But that set up a fear of spiders, arachnophobia, at the age of like 9. So I've got these things starting to build in my life that I can't cope with, but I know that alcohol tends to solve the problem. Yeah? Fair Oaks over here, one time, same place we lived there, we saw a jet plane coming down for a landing and its wing was on fire. And we knew that it was taking off the tops of the trees of our house on the other side of 41, and the runway was quite a bit of ways off. And we took off running, myself and my two brothers, toward the runway and toward where that plane was going down, and we heard a big boom and a fireball go up, and we arrived on the scene pretty much before anybody else did. You can see where the plane come down through the trees, tearing them up, and it hit that house. It hit a house and it exploded, and the lady was running out of the house on fire, and a man came across from the road with a blanket and knocked her down and put her out. My two brothers kept running, but something caught my eye, and I slid to a stop and looked up to a tree on the right, and it was part of the flight helmet, the pilot's helmet, and his brains were in it. And I froze, and I just stood there, locked on that. I couldn't move. And I could hear all this screaming and yelling and the fire going on and the people and everything, and my brothers were over there to the side. And finally this cop comes running up and he grabs me and spins me around and looks at me and asks me my name, and I couldn't tell him. But he looks around and sees my two brothers and yells at them and asks if they know who this kid is. And they said, yeah, that's our little brother. And the cop said, well, get him the hell out of here now. And they dragged me off to the house. And they were pissed at me because they couldn't stay and watch what was going on because they had to take me home then. And I had nightmares for about 2 weeks every night after that. And Dad was a strange kind of character. He didn't think boys should cry about anything, so when I'd wake up screaming in terror at night, crying, he would come in there and beat the hell out of me until I quit crying. So I learned how to begin to shut down emotions, how to shut down care, how to shut down the ability to cry by the time I was 9, 10 years old. So now here's more stuff building in my life that I don't know how to deal with, can't manage, do not know how to figure out, but I know drinking helps to solve the problem. So drinking early on in my life began to be a solution, and it was the only solution that I had because nobody gave a damn in the family to talk to them about it. Everybody was the same way about it, and everybody's same solution was get drunk. And at family reunions, it was not uncommon to see people pull out guns and knives and start shooting at each other. And as a matter of fact, by the time I was 12, we used to have our family reunions over at in Marietta. And we had a problem one time where the usual happened, and the sheriff showed up, and by the time they got everything settled down and everybody packed into ambulances and hauled off who had bullet wounds and knife cuts that were too severe, they asked that we didn't have our family reunions in Georgia anymore, not just Dodge County, but Georgia. So we didn't. They just kind of broke up. By the time I was 14, I'm already starting to break into houses and rob things from you to buy what I wanted. Now, the whole time in high school, in school, when I'm coming through school, I'm having trouble. And I don't know why my numbers are backwards and my letters don't look like your letters do. But see, the name of this place that we're standing in is called the Rebo's Club, but to me it's called the Sober Club because I have dyslexia. Yeah? My mind rearranges stuff, and they didn't catch that back then in the late 50s and early 60s. They had no idea what dyslexia was. They just thought that I was retarded, and that's what they told my parents, that your son is retarded, and he needs to be in the special groups because he just don't get it. He's stupid. So now I'm being labeled in school, grammar school coming up, that you're retarded, you're stupid. There's something wrong with you, boy. It's what I always got from everybody. and I'm just frustrated as hell. So what's my solution? Take a drink. And even all the way up into high school, I'm drinking. I'm drinking to solve my problem because I can't get grades like you do. And I've been laid back in school. I've been set back 4 times coming up through there already. So everybody that I grew up with and everything has moved on already. And Claude's the slow, stupid, retarded one. That's tough to deal with. As a teenager, alcohol kept me from committing suicide. It really did. I could understand thoroughly why teenagers commit suicide. Because when you get enough crap happening in your life that you can't figure out and you don't know how to deal with, and alcohol is the only thing you can get your hands on, yeah. It kept me from blowing my brains out. But all this time, I'm learning how to physically fight. Because I got 2 brothers that are pain in the ass whenever you took, they're twins. So whenever you took one of them on, you had to take the other one on. So by the time I was 12, I learned how to take at least 2 people on and win. And I got good at that. I got real good at it. And in school, whenever somebody started calling me names and stuff, I would take you down. And I found out real quick, if you carry a pocket knife and you cut them, they'll back off. But if they come back for more, you cut them again. And my old man always taught me that you don't lose a fight. Because I lost 3 fights in my lifetime. And all 3 of those, when I got home and he found out that I lost those fights, I got my ass beat. I mean, severely. So I found out real quick, you don't lose. You go to any length to win. I don't care what you got to do. He told me, you don't lose. So I never lost. And I hurt people severely. All through my teens. Kicked out of 2 high schools for causing sit-ins and riots. Now there's a rumor that the totem pole at Cherokee High School used to be 5 feet taller with more of those little faces on it and everything, and that at some time or another at 3 o'clock in the morning that it had exploded and blown up and that I had something to do with it. I plead the 5th Amendment. But I was in construction every time I was kicked out of school, which was frequently, and every time that I was out for the summer, my dad drove a tractor. He was a tractor operator, so every time I was out of school, I was on a job. When I was 12 years old, he came home one day with a stick of dynamite, a plastic cap, 100 foot of detonation cord, and a battery, and tossed it to me and said, here, go figure that out. Most people don't do that to their kids unless they're really trying to kill them. But I guess he figured I was the bright one of the family. So I figured it out. Because I'd watched some of the other guys before, how you take a pocket knife, make a hole in there, stick that detonator cap in there, put them wires on it, get out there behind a tree somewhere and touch that battery to those 2 ends, and that dynamite will go off. So I knew early on how to play with explosives. And it became a deadly part of my life. Because if I couldn't fix the problem, I'd blow it up. And it didn't matter to me if you were in the way. Because I had no ability to care. I had no ability to love. I had no compassion whatsoever for humanity at all. And I figured life owed me. And you were going to pay. I would take whatever it was that I needed from you. And if you got in the way, I'd fix it. Because I was also taught, because of moonshine and the family background, that those revenuers, government revenuers, make damn good fertilizer. And I knew by the time I was 15 years old how to get rid of a body. Effectively. Non-traceably. And I carried that technique with me through the rest of my life. I was getting arrested a lot, getting in trouble, being out after dark, downtown Atlanta selling moonshine and mood mind altering chemicals and other things that I shouldn't have had my hands on that caused massive destruction, but they never could pin anything on me. They just knew I was associated with here and there. I had several cousins that were in the different motorcycle gangs around, so I had my ins and outs all over the streets of Atlanta and all the way around in Canton, Woodstock, everywhere out here. I knew everybody. They all knew me. And they all knew that you didn't cross Claude, not without serious consequences. Finally, I wound up kicked out of school for the last time. Dad and I get into a knockdown, drag-out fight. And I actually knocked his lights out, went in the house, got a pan of water and soda it on him, and brought him around, and I said, "You'll never lay a hand on me again." The next day, he kicked me out of the house. I went to stay with some friends for a while. Then one of my sisters let me move in with her, and her husband had a bad habit of drinking and doing mood and mind altering chemicals too. And it didn't take long before me and him just didn't mix at all. By now, I'm nearly 18 years old. And he pulls a few strings. It's the Vietnam War is going on by then, and my number is about to come up on the draft. And it was only, you either had to leave the U.S., keep dodging the draft, or join the military. So I knew that if I went into the Army, my chances of survival were real thin, because I'd seen a lot of the guys that I went to high school with that went to the Army and never came back from Vietnam except in a casket. I didn't want to join the Navy because I kind of got a fear of being out in the ocean. Didn't like that idea, so the Air Force seemed like a good idea. Amazingly enough, we were able to get me into the Air Force. Went through basic training, and I was built for basic training. By then, I was 5'9", had a chiseled bod. I could fight. I was a street fighter. I had some good common sense, and I knew how to tell guys what to do and how to do it. And they recognized that early on in my little military career and the basic training. And by the time that we were most of the way through basic training, the training instructors decided that I was going to be one of the new little instructors to help teach the guys stuff and everything. But he had a few little problems with me. One of them was laundry. I didn't like to do laundry. So we had all got our brand new fatigues that day, and those things will chafe you unless they're washed first. You know, all your khakis and your fatigues and all your clothes, and everybody is running around in those big boxers that they give you in the military and basic training. And me and this one other guy were ordered to go do everybody's laundry downstairs, and it had 12 washers and 12 dryers in a row. And we had these 5-gallon containers of bleach and these 5-gallon containers of soap to do laundry with. So I was going to show this instructor that I don't do laundry. We loaded up all of those washers and dryers, well, all those washers with all those clothes, and I just walked down through there with gallons, with one of those 5 gallons of Clorox, and just emptied it from one end to the other. And the same thing with one of those 5 gallons of soap, and just emptied it from one end to the other. And we shut the lids, and we turned on the machines, and we stepped outside and shut the door behind us, and me and this other guy were having just a good time talking about how great it was going to be in the Air Force and this stupid job we got doing laundry. And we were just smoking a cigarette, having a good time. About 20 minutes passes, and the training instructor comes back. You know those guys can pop up out of thin air? And this guy did. He just, all of a sudden, he was there, and he jumped both of us and wanted to know how that laundry was going. And I told him that it was going just fine, sir. And he said, "Open that door." And when we opened the door to the laundry room, soap came out of it. I mean, the whole door was full of soap coming out. It looked like a I Love Lucy thing or something. And he ordered us to make a hole, and we started digging soap out of that doorway so he could get into the first machine. And he takes his swagger he's got and flips the door open and digs in there and pulls up a set of green fatigues that immediately disintegrate off of the swagger and fall back in there from all the bleach, which was burning your eyes at the time. And he flipped open every one of those washers and dug in there and pulled up fatigues and khakis that just disintegrated off of his swagger. And he was the least pleased with me. He was pissed. Well, I wound up doing every dirty detail that he could come up with for the next week until they made enough clothes for everybody. Who were 250 guys were sitting in their boxers for a week up in the barracks. They're sitting in there reading manuals on how to clean guns, you know, and everything, while I'm outside running around doing everything that this instructor can come up with. Finally, we get to where we're about to graduate out of basic training, and they give you this thing called a dream sheet. where you sit down and you write down what your dreams are, what you want to be in the military, you know, what you like to work on, what kind of job you like to have. I wanted to be a mechanic and work on jet planes, but everything I have is mechanical stuff. Well, somebody in their infinite wisdom and military intelligence, and I still say those are two words that should never be used together, but they decided to take 260 guys out of all these people that are at Lackland, Texas in basic training, and they decided to make a special detachment of a security team that had never been formed before. We were a special unit of security police. Steven's having a problem. That's okay. So none of us knew exactly what that meant, that we were going to be a special detachment. But we get timed out, go back home for a little R&R, and then we got a week later that we had to report to our base, and my base was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, and it's the top command center number one for the Air Force. It's the top security base, the head honcho base for the Air Force. Nothing moves in outer space, and nothing moves in the air around this planet that they don't know about. All the top security stuff that they play with comes out of Wright-Patterson first. All that stuff travels between an area called 51 at the Lockheed Skunk Works and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And my team was the team who was supposed to take care of all of that stuff and keep it straightened out. And a new system was made for us. The next satellite that went up, the next spy satellite that went up was supposed to go to the CIA, but they bumped them and gave it to us, to my team. Now, there were 260 guys in our team that we had been cross-trained through all the other branches of the military so that we could work effectively with everyone worldwide, any of the branches in any of the operations that they had. And our satellite would keep real-time information so we could watch what was going on worldwide. My team was asked to go to Wright-Patterson, and I was the team leader on that team. And when we started on the base, they wanted to see just how well the security was at Wright-Patterson and just how well my team could operate. So there were eight of us that were given different ranks. And we were told that we had all the credentials for this rank, colonels, lieutenants, this and that and the other. And we were given all the paperwork to go along with that to see how far on the base we could infiltrate and get into the top security area. They didn't expect us to get far, but they wanted to see how well the team could do. So we were allowed to have 3 days in an apartment off base to figure a strategy, and I figured out a way to get all my men into all five top security areas on that base. And within 2 hours of us getting on base, we infiltrated all the top security areas. And we had these little fake grenades that we could pull a pin on and throw out there. And we're going past metal detectors and everything. I taught these guys how to get through all the top security crap on the base. We got through. And by the end of 2 hours of doing this, we had effectively shut down the entire base, had control of satellite systems and weaponry systems with nuclear capability on that base and in several locations around the world. That caused heads to roll at Wright-Patterson. They were calling generals and colonels and lieutenants on the mat and chewing ass out. How did this team of green recruits get in, infiltrate their way all the way on the base to the top security areas and manage to take control theoretically? Well, they liked the idea of the way that I ran the team and let me continue. There were things that I did when I was on that team that you shouldn't do to God's kids. But it helped if you didn't have any conscience at all. And that was right where I was. I had no conscience. I had no ability to deal with pain, compassion, or anything. So I would get orders to go do something to somebody who was in the United States, who was a United States citizen, and how to take care of a particular problem. And these things were not morally right. But because of orders, you do what you're told. So I would go about doing what I was told, and I did that for 2 years. Exactly as ordered, what they wanted done, carrying out stuff worldwide, watching on the big screen, real time, making sure things happened. And if another group's team got in trouble, we were in charge of helping to evacuate them or get them airlifted out or get them some support in some manner. We were using toys back then in 1970 and 71 that they're just now showing y'all today. The drones and things. So it finally hit a point to where we had to go do a job that I didn't want to go do, but I had to go do it anyway. We carried out the mission, but I developed a conscience, which was something that was detrimental to the ability to do the job that they wanted done. I got back to the base after doing this one job and told my commanding general what I thought about it all, and he was pissed. So he put me on the duty of just hanging around the base and guarding buildings for a while, for a month, as a kind of a disciplinary thing for the way I crawled his ass. And now I've only got 3 stripes on my arm. So I got a badge and a gun and a special security clearance where I can use hostile if not deadly force at any time. And if you put your hand on information or start to go into a room or a building that you're not authorized to go in, I can drop you in your tracks. That was power to me. It'll make you drunk and crazy after a while. Whole time I'm still drinking. I'm drinking heavy in the military because that's my solution. It helps me to cope. I started seeing some things coming up missing here and there, and people were faking paperwork, so I started tracking what was going on, and in a month's time I had found out that there was a team that was operating on the base at Rock Patterson that was stealing some top security stuff and selling it to the Russians, and I had everything all the way down the line, even pictures of the person that they were selling the stuff to. And I took it to my commander, and he called in a group called the Office of Special Investigations, the OSI, and that's pretty much kind of the men in black suits for the Air Force. They do some extraordinary things. They started investigating and found out what was going on, that what I was telling them, the information I gave them was true. And they told me to continue following this information and turning it all into them, and I did. And after 6 months' time, they moved in and made a sting on the whole operation and caught this Russian red-handed. And our guys selling them the stuff, taking the money, everything. Well, the way it turned out, there were some congressmen and senators and generals that were mixed up in it, too. So to bail their butts out, they needed a scapegoat. And I turned out to be it. The Office of Special Investigation dropped all information about me and said they had no knowledge of me or my operations and that I was in on this thing. Didn't matter what I said, we had a special board of review, and they ordered me to lie about everything that I had come up with. And I started to develop a conscience by then, and I didn't lie, I told the truth. And the shit hit the fan. The next day, they gave me an alternative. They said, you can finish out the rest of your military career at Aviano Air Force Base in Italy, or take a dishonorable discharge. By now, they've revoked my security clearance and everything, and I'm just sitting in my room on the base, and I can't go anywhere or do anything. And I asked them to let me have 24 hours to think it over, and they did. That night, I broke into a top security building, got on that secured satellite, and called my counterpart in Aviano Air Force Base, gave him the numbers for the orders that were mine, and told him, check it out and call me back in 30 minutes. He did. And he said, well, the guy carrying these orders is supposed to be killed within 1 week of hitting the base over here in an automobile accident. So I'll set up, why? What's this information for? Why do you need to know? And I said, those orders are mine. He says, if you come over here, I have to carry out these orders. I know I trained with you, and you helped train me and everything. And I, you know, dude, I care about you, but I have to carry out these orders. He said, what's your option? I said, dishonorable discharge. He said, take the discharge. You come over here, you're dead meat. Next day, I go into the general's office, and I tell him I'll take the discharge. It usually takes, 8 hours to process a man off the base. They process me out of there in 2 hours. I hit the streets of Atlanta running. I had enough enemies in high places by then that it was a good idea for me to stay underground for a while. But I'd also done enough favors for high-ranking dignitaries, and Decatur, Rock Patterson here and there had problems happen. and other military people in high positions to cover up certain things, that I had some favors that were owed to me, too. So I went underground when I hit the streets of Atlanta for 5 years. You couldn't find me except the people who knew me well. Now, I'm drinking. I'm doing mood and mind-altered chemicals. I'm selling things that go boom, bang, and bump in the middle of the night that most people don't like to play with. And I am crazy. I got a Harley, and I would ride my Harley around, and the cops really hated it when I did that because I had the back of the tank modified in a half circle and the front of the seat modified in a half circle so it would hold a fifth of liquor standing straight up. Tell me I can't drink and drive on a motorcycle. And the way I saw it, the way I drank, the lid was just for shipping purposes. When it came up, just put those on there to keep it from spilling until it got to me. And I always took the lid off and threw it away and just stuck the bottle up right there. And I'd go down the road and I carried a 38 on my left side. And if the red light started turning red in my direction, I'd pull out a 38, shoot the damn thing out, and keep going. It didn't matter to me if people wrecked behind me. I didn't care. Cops chased me around the streets of Atlanta here. So they got sick of me beating up their cop cars. Their cops arrested me for driving disorderly and all kind of stuff all the time. So finally, one Saturday morning, a knock comes on my apartment. I look out the window, it's Cobb County Sheriff. I go to the door and I said, I ain't done nothing. He said, get dressed and get in the car. Judge wants to see you. I said, I ain't done nothing. He said, get dressed and get in the car. I got dressed, got the car. We drove over to Cobb County, and I expect to walk in the judge's chambers and just see the one judge. I walk in, and there's five judges sitting there, and they've all arrested me in all of their counties around here. And they all said, sit down, and they started reading different things that they had arrested me for over the years, so they finally made a circle, and they said, we've got a suggestion for you. We want you to leave the state of Georgia for 2 years. And I said, what if I don't want to leave? They said, well, then we are all prepared to sign a warrant to have you arrested and put in Georgia Regional Mental Institution for an indefinite period of time. And I said, and how many days do I have to get out of town? They said, 3. I was gone in 2. I went up to Virginia Beach and partied for 2 years with a Navy SEAL friend of mine. Oh, that's fun. You go tear up bars and they ask you to leave. You don't get arrested up there for that. Not when you party with Navy SEALs. 2 years later, I called them up and they let me come back to the state of Georgia. Didn't change a thing about the way that I lived and my habits and everything. I was still getting crazy. Everything continued to get worse and worse and worse. I'm losing jobs. I'm losing relationships. I can't hold a relationship because I don't know how to care for anybody. I don't know how to act around women at all. I had no ability to deal with relationships whatsoever. So the whole time, everything is going downhill in a hurry in my life. I finally wind up losing this last apartment, and I've had jobs where I've had big bucks. I had really nice cars. I've had a nice apartment down on Riverbend down there. Good-looking women that were models from the Atlanta Mall days. I've had bucks. I mean bucks. And I always seem to bring it down on top of my head, just like our book says. We get everything set exactly where we want it, and we'll pull it right down on top of our head. And I always did, but I never could figure out why. But I just pick myself up and start over again. Finally, it all hits the fan where I'm getting less and less functional. The shakes are getting so bad from my drinking that alcohol doesn't stop the shakes anymore. I shook continuously. And that's where I couldn't hold a job anymore. And I'm sitting in my sister's house, and she finally called the cops one day. And she calls the cops one day and tells them to come get me and take me to Georgia Regional Mental Institution. The cops come into the house. There's 5 cars. And we got a little problem going on at the moment. I don't think he's going. You know how alcoholics are fighters? So I'm sitting in my sister's house. And the cops come in. There's five cop cars that pull up. There's two cops in each car, and none of them are under 6 foot tall, around 300 pounds. I mean, they're all big boys. They know I'm a fighter. They know I'm drunk, and they know I'm crazy. And they said, you can go one of two ways. You can go easy, standing up, or you can go hard, laying out. But we're going to cuff you, and you're going with us, and you're going to Georgia Regional Mental Institution, and you're going now. I sensed I had a problem. So I decided that standing up, walking on my own, was a hell of a lot better than having a headache later. So I let them cuff me, head to toe. They loaded me in a police car, and every time they got to a different county, they'd swap me out of that car into the next county. And by the time they got me to Atlanta, they took me into Georgia Regional Mental Institution. They ran me up with Thorazine. They took the chains off and the handcuffs. They put me in a straitjacket and stuck me in a padded room. And I'm sitting there shaking, Thorazine out of my head, in a straitjacket in a padded room, and it crosses my mind, Claude, you're not going crazy. You are crazy. And I realized that I had brought all this on myself. It was my drinking that got me into this place. My family members were locking me up in a mental institution because them and society were tired of handling me. I sat there all night. The next morning they come in and the psychiatrist sat up and started talking to me. And what I found out was, it's supposed to take two family members to sign you into there. Well, all my family members were so damn scared. I mean, none of them would sign the papers. So one of my brother-in-laws, who did not like me, signed the papers. So once I found out that I was, they found out pretty much, that I was falsely imprisoned here, they turned me loose. 3 months later, I hit a low point to where suicide was the best idea I could come up with. I'm laying on the floor, came out of a blackout, laying on the floor of my nephew's apartment where I'd been drinking for a month, and I'm shaking so bad I can't hardly breathe. And a phone number comes into my mind with crystal clarity. I call an old buddy of mine, and he comes over, picks me up, puts me in his truck, and takes me to the hospital. Kennestone Hospital, the doctors start taking my blood and looking at me, and they're going, after the blood work comes back, they're going, we don't believe you're breathing. My kidney and liver were shutting down. I was yellow with jaundice, and I shook uncontrollably all the time. And they looked at my blood work, and they said, Mr. Walter, your blood cells are breaking down in your blood vessels. We only see this condition in a morgue. We don't know why you're still breathing. And they started bringing their students that they were taking in to look at this case of an alcoholic. They said, this is third stage alcoholism. This is the last stage alcoholism. This guy shouldn't be breathing. And they're asking me all these stupid questions like, do you drink? How much do you drink? Do you think you have a problem with your drinking? And I'm just sitting there shaking going, these people have got to be out of their freaking mind. What is this you think? You know? Finally, my friend calls around and finds a room at a rehab center close by that will give me a 30-day stay. The reason I got a 30-day stay there was because a fellow who was rather well off had went down and paid cash for a stay at that rehab center. That night he had went home, wrote a suicide note, got drunk, got in his Cadillac, ran into an oak tree and killed himself. So my buddy had called around in the rehab center and said, well, strangely enough, we just happen to have a bed available for the next 30 days. It's paid for. He's getting down here in an hour. He's got the room. My buddy took me down there, and when I stepped out of his truck, it was late in the evening in May. It was just about dusk, and I started walking with a little grocery bag full of dirty clothes toward the door as he drove off, said good luck, and he drove off, and I started walking toward the door of that rehab center, and I could see people walking around inside, and I could hear them laughing and talking, and I felt, as low as you could get. They brought me off the alcohol just enough to stabilize me to let me turn me loose to the rehab center, and I started walking up to that door, and my legs quit working. And I fell down on my knees, and I started crawling toward the door of that rehab center with my little bag of dirty clothes. And when I got up close to the door, this lady who worked in there, one of the nurses, saw me coming, and she opened up the door and held it open, this big glass door, and she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yes, please." And she got me up, and they hauled me in, and they checked me in, and they're all shaking their heads. And they got me a bed, and they laid me out in the bed and gave me some medicine. And the next 3 or 4 days, I remember coming to here and there, them waking me up to give me medicine and trying to get me to eat. And I couldn't, nothing would stay down. I drank to the point where my body wouldn't take food anymore. It had been over a month since I'd had anything solid that I could remember. That's why the kidney and the liver were shutting down. I'm yellow with jaundice and I shook all the time. I was dying, literally. I couldn't hold any solid food down anymore. So one morning I come to, and the nurse is in my face. She's going, "Claude, you've got to go to the kitchen. You've got to eat. You've got to eat something." What I didn't know was that the staff was taking bets on what day and hour I would die. Because they'd never seen a case like that come in before, ever. But they knew that there was no way that you could be in that shape physically and not eating in 4 and 5 days and live. So finally, I crawled out of the bed, shook all the way into the kitchen, and I sat down and they gave me a bowl of Fruit Loops. Well, it was colorful anyway. I sat there and I shook. You know, I shook so bad when I came in, I could thread a sewing machine while it was running. It was damn bad. And I'm eating this bowl of Fruit Loops, and they had a little trash can there beside me because they had anticipated the result. And I started eating, and everybody's milling around me, and I can't look up at nobody. I mean, I'm just the lowest piece of crap on the planet. So I'm staring at this bowl, and I'm eating, and it take a bite, see if it'll stay, take a bite, see if it'll stay. Finally, I get the last mouthful of Fruit Loops down, and there's milk and Fruit Loops scattered all around the bowl and all the way all down my chest and everything. And these applause break out. And I look up, and everybody in the rehab center in the kitchen in there and in the dining area and the staff are all applauding that I had managed to get something to stay down. So they figured I might live. That afternoon, this was a lady, we had an in-house meeting, and a lady came named Augie to do the meetings for us from a place called the Howe Place, which is now my home group. And she started talking about this book and how she had gotten out from under alcohol and how her life was crazy, and everything that she talked about I could relate to. I knew exactly what she was talking about, how she felt, the big hole on the inside, having no emotions. Everything she talked about was exactly the way I was. And so finally I asked her, how do you do this? And she says, you get on your knees tonight and you ask the gods in the book Alcoholics Anonymous to remove the craving and the obsession, and he will. So I got on my knees on that sixth night in the rehab center, and I asked this guy from the book Alcoholics Anonymous to remove the craving and the obsession for alcohol and drugs. And on the seventh morning when I woke up, they were gone. And the sense of peace and ease had been placed back in. So the first thing I felt was something inside. Something had been removed and something had been replaced. And I knew, I didn't know exactly how this was going to work, but I knew it was going to work. So I continued to ask questions of that lady every time she came in there and start trying to figure out how y'all did this. And y'all helped me because we come to find out that I was so wet-brained that I couldn't really put two sentences together. I could figure out what I wanted to say in here, but I couldn't get it to come out of my mouth right. I was wet-brained to the point where I didn't make good sense. I couldn't put two sentences together other than please help me. And the guys would sit in the meetings, before meetings and after meetings, and they'd read the book to me and they'd ask me what I heard. They were trying to figure out what parts of the brain were still working to see what I was hearing, where I was capable of grasping this concept of how to live by this process. And I began to understand I'm powerless over alcohol because my body doesn't metabolize alcohol like other people's bodies do. I have the body of an alcoholic, and that's going to happen every time. My life's unmanageable with or without a drink. I knew that way before I got to the program, so the first step for me was easy. I understand. I just didn't know why my body was different until they explained it to me. The alcoholic body breaks down and metabolizes alcohol incorrectly. It does it in a different chemical chain than normal people does, and that will never change. So I have to smash the idea every morning that I could ever drink again, because it's ludicrous. It's going to be the same bad result that will kill me. The second step is come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. My sponsor and three old-timers that knew me, that grew up with me in construction and stuff, and I was watching all those guys, and I'd say, you know, if I ever get as bad as him, I'll quit, you know. Well, three of them were in there, and my sponsor was in there, too. And they were the ones that have written to me every day. And they all agreed that I don't think we can restore something to what never was, but they agreed that I could be introduced to sanity on a daily basis if I could begin to grasp and develop a manner of living which demands some kind of honesty in my case. So the third step was the key, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as you understood him from the book Alcoholics Anonymous, because the God I was brought up with and the Baptist here wasn't working. It didn't work for me. So I changed my concept for the word from the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that did remove the craving and the obsession. So I had that, what I built on, what that one thing that I felt on that seventh morning inside, that trust, that belief, that one feeling of peace that I gained that morning, I based the third step on. And I began to live and try to understand. I needed more psychiatric help than most people. I came in with grave emotional and mental disorders. So everybody in the first rehab center decided that I needed extra help, and they called the MAR program, and the MAR program said, we know he has no money and no insurance, but we'll take it. So I sat at my sponsor's house for a week, and on the second week, about the middle of the second week, sitting out there reading, trying to read the big book, and the little voice in my head said, go call, because I was waiting for a bed to come open in the MAR program where I could get psychiatric help. And I went up and I called, and they said, yeah, if you can get here in an hour, we've got you a bed. And what I found out was, there was a kid who had signed up in there in the MAR program, and he was 21 years old, and he had done almost his entire year there, and he was due to rotate out and go back home to Texas. His folks sent him out here to Atlanta because they heard that MAR program had the best recovery. And he was there in the program and doing his thing really good. And, you know, you've got these different apartments, and everybody in the apartment's responsible for everybody else. And if one guy screws up, everybody pays for it. What he had been doing was sneaking out at night in the evenings and getting on his bicycle, riding across town to a girlfriend that he had over there. And in the mornings, he would ride his bike back, and everybody in two apartments knew it. And nobody said anything for months. He was coming back that morning on his bicycle, and the little old lady was going to the grocery store, and the sun was in her eyes driving down the road in her car, and she didn't see him and ran over and killed him. I got a bed at the MAR program because this guy was doing something he wasn't supposed to, and it got him killed. So two people died for me to come into the program. I don't know whether that's good or bad or indifferent. It's just the way it went down. When I got there, the judge in that county heard that I was going to be coming into that program, and he had him slide a warrant into the paperwork that I signed. You sign a stack of papers 4 inches thick when you go into one of those places. And in there was that warrant, and I signed it. And I didn't find out what that warrant was till the day I got ready to leave. And what that warrant said was that if Coldwater left the facility of MAR in and of his own accord at any time, on his own, that he was to be arrested and put in Georgia Regional Mental Institution for an indefinite period of time. I got 6 months of psychiatric help with three psychiatrists. They thought that my condition warranted being accessed to all three psychiatrists day and night. I got the help that I needed to do a fourth step. I didn't even know where to start. So my fourth step started with those psychiatrists. Every day we'd find out something new about me, and we'd write it down. So it took 6 months to do a fourth step that was in-depth, that understood where the root cause of the problem was. And we went all the way back to when I was 3 years old, standing in the kitchen, watching the blood spatter. So my fourth step was as thorough as you could get on a mental level that I could remember and on a psychological level that we could dig down to. So I got back to the house place, and I worked with my regular sponsor after that, and we went through 5, I told him everything, withholding nothing, even all the stuff in the military that I still, some of the stuff I still can't talk about because I'm still under a non-disclosure agreement on a lot of that. 5, 6, 7, I did exactly what the book said to do. 8, I made my list. And there were people, there's 4 people on my list in 8 that I did not know what to do with. And my sponsor agreed that I was to leave those willing to make amends to those people indefinitely. Because there's nothing I can do with them. There's no money that I could pay, no amount of money. There's no words that I could ever say that could make up for it. And there's nothing that I could do that will solve the problem. So the best thing for me to do is leave those poor people alone. All 4 of those people I'm to leave alone. Stay out of their life and do not bother them. I had to make one amends at the end of a 38. A guy had his heart right between my eyes. And he finally decided, after I got through explaining to him where I was coming from in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I didn't have his stuff and I didn't have his money, and he could pull the trigger if he needed to, but the best that I could do was say, I'm sorry. Then he uncocked the 38, got in his truck, and left. I have spent a large amount of time in 10. I continue to take a look at me on a daily basis. Not just in the evening, but all through the day, I check my thinking with these steps and with the spiritual principles that are attached to those steps. I live this instead of just sit and talk about it for an hour. I have to. With the insanity that I have that parks itself in my head from time to time, living this is the only way to find peace in my head so my head can hit the pillow at night and I can sleep. 11. I seek through prayer and meditation all the time. Not unusual if you call me, you'll hear birds in the background because I'm up on some river or creek somewhere. And I take time to take care of me and talk with God. I got a little story I call Jesus in my pocket. About 8 months ago, in one of my morning prayer and meditations, I asked God to give me something to show people that's solid, that I could carry around in my pocket and pull out and show people that I'm hearing your voice in my head and it's not my ego trying to guide me again. That I'm doing the right things in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm helping people the way I'm supposed to and I'm living right. And that it is you that I help to direct people to. And I finished up my prayer meditation and I went on to my morning meeting, and after that I got out and I'm driving around Lake Alpena and remembering all the little places I used to go fishing and swimming as a kid. And I hear God's voice through the clouds. Yes, sir. They said, go to the flea market. And I said, the one on 41? He said, yeah. So I drive over to the flea market in 41, and I get out, and I said, which building? He says, the one on the top of the hill on the left. So I go up to the building, and I say, okay. Which booth? He said, halfway down on the left. Go in that one. So I go halfway down on the left, and I go in, say hi to the lady running the thing. There's just shelves and stuff everywhere, and flea market stuff, junk jewelry everywhere. And there's this shelf on this drawer up here on the top, on the left. He says, pull that thing down. So I pull this little shelf thing down, and it's junk jewelry laying all over it, and there's this little round cylinder. He said, take the cylinder. So I took the cylinder, and I put the thing back up there. He said, open it. And I said, it opens? He said, yeah, untwist the top. Pour it out in your hand. So I untwist the top, and I pour it out in my hand, and it's this tiny figurine of Jesus showing you his heart, his compassionate heart. This is not a religious symbol to me. This is a spiritual message. I live a spiritual program. Other people want to find religion however they need to, that's fine. I live a spiritual way of life. So this is Jesus in my pocket that I carry to help people to understand when you pray and meditate, expect an answer and you'll get one. But you have to learn how to listen. You have to learn how to do. And it's not uncommon that I'll be driving down the road from point A to point B and he'll go, go see so-and-so. I will stop and go see that person immediately. I don't say, well, you know, can I do that later? I got something I really wanted to do, like go fishing. He'll tell me from time to time, he said, call so-and-so and talk to them. They're in trouble. They're hurting. And I'll call them and the person will go, I've been looking for your number and I couldn't find it, but I desperately needed to talk to you. And I'm going, yeah, I know. What's that? Learn to listen. Learn to do. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a new life. I have no problems physically from the condition I came in, the liver and the kidney are shutting down, yellow with jaundice, and I shook 24 hours a day in my blood vessels, and my blood cells were breaking down in my blood vessels. That is nothing less than a miracle. And the only thing I did was become willing to live by this process and smash the idea that I could ever drink again and learn how to trust God of my understanding with my life. And to be willing to help another alcoholic, to go to any length to help another alcoholic and addict to get one step closer to a power greater than themselves in this process. This is my life. Whatever I do to make money to pay my bills is whatever I do to make money to pay my bills. That's not how I define myself now. I define myself as a spiritual being and having a human body doing God's work for God's kids. This is who and what I am. A member of Alcoholics Anonymous in pretty good standing. Right now I'm on unemployment. So are 50 million other people, so I'm not alone. You know, I do the best that I can. I get by one day at a time. And I'd like to thank you all for putting up with me this afternoon. Y'all have a good one.